The Guardian.
Hello, I'm James Randerson, and welcome to this week's special musical edition of Science Weekly. In this podcast, we'll be asking why this is music and why this is just noise.
A melody is not a melody until it is heard. So it's merely a sequence of vibrations in the air, which could be a completely random sequence of notes, which wouldn't be heard as a melody at all by a human listener. The melody is only a melody because of the way we hear it.
The methods that we use to look at processes in the brain while we listen to or produce music mainly comprise electroencephalography, but also functional magnetic resonance imaging. Other researchers also use positron emission tomography, PET.
Music seems to be as ubiquitous as speech, as ubiquitous as language. It also seems, in all cultures we know of, to be something that seems to be held to have some communicative value. Just what it's communicating and how it's communicating it is in question.
There's a quote of Mendelssohn's where he famously said that music is too precise to express in words, and that seems to me to be a clarion call of what music almost certainly is. And if it is, then the call is to discover what is it that's being described.
In this programme, we'll be looking inside the brain to figure out what's going on when you listen to your favourite tune, why language really might be music to our ears, and how music can also be a cure.
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start.
Where did music come from, and why did it emerge? Here's Ian Cross from the University of Cambridge on why our ancestors started making music in the first place.
There are several ways of considering the relationship between music and evolutionary theory. In the first account, music has no real relation to evolution. Music is something rather like chess or maths. Some complex human faculty that we do because it's fun and because it exercises other, more functional faculties. And that's a view that was promulgated by Steve Pinker in his 1996 book, How the Mind Works. It's an interesting theory. It's, however, profoundly wrong. It's wrong because it treats music as complexly patterned sound that we value only because it makes us feel good, and that we engage with solely by listening. And while music might appear to take that form, in most non-Western cultures, music is actually active and interactive. It's something you do rather than you listen to. There's often no distinction between music and dance, or what we might think of as music and dance. And in fact, when we look rather more closely at our own Western culture, music is rather more embedded in complex, active behaviours than would appear to be the case if we think of music as Mozart and a CD to which we can listen because we like it. Many people in Western cultures actively participate in music, from karaoke through to participation in a church choir through to attendance at raves. Okay, you're not producing the sound other than through your footfalls, but you're engaging in the music actively. It's also something that appears in all known cultures. Now, if it's active, interactive, appears in all known cultures, and in all known cultures is felt somehow to be meaningful, then that provides quite cogent reasons for why we might seek an evolutionary account, or might at least seek to frame the relationship between music and evolutionary theory in some principled terms.
As ever, Charles Darwin, the grandfather of evolution, got there first. His idea was that music was all about showing off to the opposite sex, a kind of auditory peacock's tail. Others have suggested that music has a function in survival. It might, for example, have helped foster social cohesion as a replacement for mutual grooming. Or perhaps it was more about intimidating other groups by showing how close-knitted your tribe was. After hearing that racket, you might think twice about grabbing some of your neighbouring group's territory, or indeed, taking them on at rugby. But Ian Cross thinks that music's flexible ability to convey meaning, of which we'll hear more later, made it a social evolutionary tool.
Music seems to be extremely good, extremely useful, to have a considerable potential for managing situations of social uncertainty. And in fact, if one looks at many of the contexts, if not all the contexts in which music is apparent worldwide across cultures, one can characterize them, roughly speaking, as situations of a degree of social uncertainty. Now, for a social animal such as ourselves, a complexly social animal, it is extremely important to preserve that sociality, the capacity to be social, because that's a key component of our fitness as a member of the human race, human species. And in that sense, it makes sense to think of music as having been evolutionarily functional in promoting and sustaining that capacity for sociality.
So maybe music is not auditory cheesecake after all. Now, until recently, it was thought that music's ability to reach the parts that other sounds could not reach was uniquely human, but scientists are now debating whether this really is the case. Adina Shackner from Harvard has found that certain birds can also be persuaded to get off the perch and into their dancing shoes. Marcus Pierce asked her about her research.
So up until very, very recently, there were a lot of kind of anecdotal reports in the literature that entrainment was actually a uniquely human ability. And a lot of people had thrown around very big claims that we were the only species that could dance to a beat and things like that. But there really wasn't very much comparative data. So what we did was we actually went and tested birds and other species, and we found that vocal learning birds in particular had the ability to entrain to a beat. And what I mean by vocal learning is something really specific. It's not just the ability to learn auditory things. It's actually the ability to mimic auditory things, so imitate them. And what we found is that the specific birds that we found that can entrain are always the species that also can mimic sound. In our first experiment, we had data from two different birds. One was Alex the parrot, and we basically went to the lab, and we had created some novel rhythmic auditory stimuli, just very natural, and played them to the bird. And these were songs that he had never heard before. We had made them ourselves, so he couldn't have heard them before. And we had them at different tempos, and we played them to him in the lab, and what we saw was this amazing phenomenon where he started to bob his head to the beat. And what we found was that across many different tempos, him and another bird, Snowball the Cockatoo, who's been pretty famous on the internet and on YouTube, you can search for him yourself and find some videos, matched the tempo of the songs with their movements over a big range of tempos. So if you change the speed of the song, they change their speed along with it. And not only that, but they're actually synchronized to the beats themselves, so their movements are in time with the beats, and they'll actually synchronize with the music as it changes.
Why are they doing this? What are the evolutionary origins of this?
So what's really interesting about this is that in the wild, if you go out into the forest, Amazon, what you'll see is that although all of these types of animals do produce rhythmic behaviors, they never actually entrain those behaviors to an external beat, as far as we know. And we've kind of asked many people who are very familiar with bird behavior, and no one can think of an instance in which a bird is actually listening to an auditory beat and lining up their movements with it like you would to entrain. So what that tells us is that it really can't have been selected for directly by natural selection, because it's not actually expressed. So the only way that it could have emerged, and it must have emerged since it exists, is through selection for another type of cognitive mechanism, which then caused entrainment to emerge as a byproduct of it. So basically, you're getting pressure to select for some other skill, and along with that skill, they're pulling along kind of the brain mechanisms necessary for another capacity. So in this case, there's actually really strong reasons to think that what that mechanism might be is vocal learning, or in other words, vocal imitation.
And do you think that could be a possible evolutionary explanation for music, for human music?
So that's a much bigger question, and one that I think a lot of us are interested in. But yes, it does kind of lend credence to the hypothesis that music originated as a series of exaptations, or a series of taking one capacity and using it for something it wasn't originally evolved to do.
So it's not just humans who can get into the groove. Music is clearly useful for communication, but not for everything. Try ordering a meal by playing licks on your Fender Stratocaster. The notion of what music actually means turns out to be a tricky question.
Music has only an extremely limited capacity to denote objects and events in that sort of strictly informative way. It's not a very good communicative medium for telling people about things that are happening in the world, or warning them of things, or instructing them to do things. It doesn't have that kind of propositional type of semantics that language does. If I say to you, I am sitting at my desk, I can do that with a structured series of sounds in a way that I can't really if I was to try and play the violin down the telephone to you or something like that.
In language, we can express semantically decomposable propositions. So we can utter a complex sentence that can be decomposed into meanings, each of which can be specified in terms of a simple proposition. We can't do that with music. We can say the cat sat on the mat, but we can't even sing the cat, or the mat, or sat.
Eric Clark from Oxford University and Ian Cross there. But maybe music helps us to communicate in a more abstract way. Paul Robertson's a violinist who led the Medici String Quartet for more than 30 years. He's also spent many years studying how the brain and music fit together. He sees music not as a limited form of expression, but as superior to language.
Music is a way of instantly expressing really complex packages of intention, emotion, state of arousal, a social role, all of these things which we only have very clumsy language to explore. I believe that music exists as a precursor to language and communication and cognition, that it's from what we would now call musical response that our verbal language has developed. Therefore, verbal constructs are essentially musical in their organization. That's my own belief. And as you know, there's quite a lot of supporting evidence that would appear to support the idea, particularly the sheer precociousness of our musicality. So we're responding before birth. We're actually in musical communication as our first bonds of trust and affection between mother and child. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Hi, Nathia.
So I may not be able to order a meal, but I can at least express emotions and a desire to communicate. One thing that music and language both share is that the way our brain perceives them depends heavily on what we expect will be coming next. We expect certain types of words, nouns, verbs and so on, to come in a certain order and at certain points in a sentence. And in generating expectations, our brains might process music and language in similar ways.
Expectation is simply the phenomenon of predicting what's going to come next, and it seems to be a widespread aspect of human cognition. We often have some implicit prediction of what's about to happen next in a sequence of events, and it's thought to be very important for music. As we listen to music, we have some sense of what the next note might be, or the next chord, or when the next beat might come, and this is thought to be very important in music perception because composers are thought to play with our expectations, sometimes confirming them, sometimes denying them, and this is thought to provide a lot of the aesthetic interest in music of all different types. There's growing evidence that we do the same thing in language. We have some implicit predictions about what the next word is going to be in a sentence, or what the next category of word, whether it's going to be a noun or a verb, and this in language, that it somehow helps us cope with the problem of processing sentences which are complicated, rapidly unfolding sequences of information in time, and that having expectations facilitates that process. there could be real overlap in the way the brain processes these things. One musical example would be a cadence. So in a cadence, the music comes to a close. Typically, it ends on what's called a tonic chord after a dominant chord. It's a well-known gesture in tonal music. But sometimes a composer will do something other than end that way in order to give the music a different feel, what's called a deceptive cadence. He might end on a different chord, which doesn't have that same sense of complete closure, but which is a little bit surprising and sort of evocative. In language, when you are hearing speech or reading language, oftentimes you might have if I stop a sentence in midstream and you wonder what the next word will be, you might have predicted what that word was going to be. But research seems to be suggesting that you can't predict the exact word you're going to hear, but you still have a sense of what type of word that will be. Will it be a verb? Will it be a noun? And having that expectation actually facilitates the processing of that word.
Annie Patel there from the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego. So, what about the musical brain? Stefan Kolsch, a neuroscientist at Sussex University, looks at how our brains and bodies react to surprise when linguistic and musical expectations are thwarted.
Musical grammar is processed in very similar brain areas as the linguistic grammar. When we hear an unexpected musical event, our brain generates an emotional response. So what you see in the electric brain responses is a very early brain response, which is maximal at around 180 to 200 milliseconds. And this brain response is maximal over frontal brain regions, but also, at least when the response is strong enough, an alteration of our heart rate, of our heart rate variability, of our breathing rate, of hormones in our body, of immune parameters in our bodies, and so forth.
So violating our expectations could help explain why music tugs at our heartstrings and presses our emotional buttons. Just looking at the brain, however, may not tell the whole story. Computers may not sound like the best tools to examine something as touchy-feely as music, but Geraint Wiggins from Goldsmiths takes another, complementary approach, building computer models of how the musical mind works.
In any study of mental abilities, we have a problem because, for one thing, brains are far too complicated to understand at the moment. We're just really at the very beginning of understanding how brains work. And also because the relationship between minds and brains at the moment is entirely assumed. We don't understand what it is. We know there is one, but we don't understand what it is at all. So in order to study how minds work, one has to work at a sort of imaginative level. So a very good way to understand how a mind works is to build a model of it that works in the way you think the mind does. The kind of thing we might be doing at this stage in our studies, computational studies of music, is building models of particular musical activities. So one of the things that we experience in melody is a feeling of expectation, of rise and fall of the music. And studies have been done by colleagues in America and in Britain on exactly what people do expect in the context of melody. So if we build a model on a computer which behaves in a particular way according to a particular theory, then we can perhaps begin to propose that theory as an explanation for why people behave in the way that they do in these experiments, or rule it out as a candidate because it doesn't model.
But how does the full musical experience come about? Here's Paul Robertson again.
The beauty of having a high enough degree of shared expectation is you can then have the deliciousness of undoing it. And as the leader of a group, I often felt, which I sometimes cause terrible ructions, but I often felt that my role was to disrupt the expectation. So we would rehearse, because I was an obsessive rehearser, we would rehearse sometimes literally thousands of hours. And then we'd get on stage and I'd do something completely different, which caused terrible grief for those who were perhaps less experienced, didn't realise what was happening. And the one thing that I believe all human beings massively alert to is expectation and the advent of the unexpected. It's what keeps us alive.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just being handed a piece of paper. In just breaking news, scientists have used music to develop a perpetual motion machine. Not really. I was just using Paul Robertson's idea to keep our producer on her toes. But music can create a sense of physical space and motion within that space. Here's Eric Clark again.
People often experience a strong sense of the approach of something, which is at first rather distant and is becoming nearer. And of course, you know, there is nothing physically, nowhere in that real space of the club is anything physically moving at all. It is that the sounds, you know, trace out the sounds of what would happen if something was moving. A lot of club dance music will start with kind of rather indistinct sounds. Increasing amounts of information will be added to the mix. And as that happens, what audiences often experience is a sense of a sound source approaching them, coming nearer so as to be revealed. And then at a certain point, often what happens is that this kind of indistinct but increasingly articulated sound will reach a particular point when suddenly, for instance, the bass drum some powerful percussive layer will be added to the mix, and the whole club will erupt into dancing, because everyone will now recognize exactly where the downbeats are and how they should move their bodies and all that kind of stuff. So over that initial period, people often experience a strong sense of the approach of something, which is at first rather distant and is becoming nearer. And of course, you know, there is nothing physically, nowhere in that real space of the club is anything physically moving at all. It is that the sounds, you know, trace out the sounds of what would happen if something was moving.
As you've heard, scientists have found out a lot about the psychology of music. But is any of it any use? According to the renowned neurologist Oliver Sacks, it is. He says that musical perception, musical sensibility, musical emotion, and musical memory can survive long after other forms of memory have disappeared. Music of the right kind can serve to orient and anchor a patient when almost nothing else can. Andrea Norton at Harvard Medical School is putting this into practice. She and her colleagues are using music to develop a new therapy for stroke patients who have lost the ability to speak.
The therapy that we've been working with is called melodic intonation therapy, and it uses a very simple prosody of speech kind of approach. It uses two pitches, and the way that you would construct any phrase for melodic intonation therapy would be to use a higher pitch for any syllable that would be naturally accented in speech. So the melody of whatever you're saying is going to follow the contour of a spoken passage. So the therapy begins with very simple phrases that are two syllables. So you might say, ice cream, because as you would speak it, you'd say, ice cream. Or you might say, I love you. Or, I am thirsty. So we are using a minor third because that's something that is universally found in all music systems around the world, and also because it's a little bit narrower. It follows more closely to speech, and the idea of the therapy after you've gone through the three levels of treatment is to transition patients back to speaking. So it's not to actually get them to sing and stay singing forever, but it's to get them back to speech.
What sorts of results do you get with this therapy?
The results are pretty remarkable, actually. We can take people in 5 minutes who have not said their own name since they had their stroke, and you can get them to say their name in 5 minutes.
The results are relatively long-lasting, are they?
We have been following several of our patients over the period of a few years, and we have people who are as many as almost 4 years past finishing their therapy who have actually continued to improve.
Paul Robertson also uses music as treatment. He started out by booking his quartet into not just concert halls, but hospitals. More recently, he has worked on how music can help people with Alzheimer's.
Music is a very potent way of reaching people, even when they are, to all intents and purposes, lost for other means of communication. we will relate to things that carry meaning for us. And in that sense, meaning is confirmed by a social context and a personal memory. And with Alzheimer's and dementias generally, very often, as the disease advances, there's a process of what's called retrogenesis, which is basically that information and material that's most recently acquired is first lost. So as we end up with earliest memory as the most deepest and engaging. So you can actually track people back through their earliest musical memory, right back to what I would call archetypal memory, where heartbeat and breathing and pulse of walking and so on and so forth are actually the things that we're engaging with. I mean, that's part of the fascination of music to me, is that it touches us at such very primitive levels, even whilst it's engaging our very clever monkey brains in a much more sort of recent evolutionary terms, much more recent sort of developments.
From its evolution to its relationship with language and its usefulness in treatment, music opens a rich window into our minds. But how much do scientists really understand? And how much more is there to discover? Here's Paul Robertson with the final word.
I think the full impact of science and music, or the science of music, has yet to occur, because I think we're just standing at the very threshold. I mean, I am very impassioned with the work I'm fortunately able to do with young medics down at the Peninsula Med School, where we use the language of music, or the experience of music, I suppose it's a bit corny, but it's really to reach parts that other other disciplines don't reach. It is an extraordinary thing. I mean, it seems a very simple idea, but one of the first exercises I now do with my students is I ask them to make a sort of desert island disc list of the music that, for whatever reason, they would currently use to define themselves. And what is fascinating is even the simplest conversation about, well, why is this piece here? What does it mean to you? The stuff that comes up, you know, we're not accidental. We may be unconscious, but we're never accidental in our choice of listening. And the fact that all of us, I think every single human being who's functioning anything like what I would call normally, uses music continually to reinforce their sense of self. You only have to look at any teenager with an iPod. That's how they're defining themselves. And it's very subtle to their peer group, who they relate to, what qualities they hold dear. And from that, you can actually unfold all sorts of unexpected narratives about, in this case with young doctors, how am I relating to my patient? What are my intentions? What are my aspirations? What are the qualities that I believe make a doctor? Really important issues which are very hard to explore in the language of science alone.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.